Let's talk a little bit about finding where you can find a Supreme Court case without, you know, having access to a big fancy database like LexisNexis. Again, probably you're not going to find maybe some more minor cases, but big cases we could use in debate could potentially work. Now, somebody explain to me how we could use a Supreme Court case in a debate realm. Why is that even relevant to what we're doing here as debaters? Yes.
Could it kind of like within inherency? Is it already passed? What's the current situation?
No, not so much what I was thinking of. Somebody else has a role. Yes.
I think it provides the basis of how the issue is currently viewed under current case law.
Not so much what I was thinking about. Somebody else want to toss us an idea out here? Yes.
Is there some constitutionality implications there because they are interpreting the Constitution's review?
And what kind of argument could we possibly make on that, maybe?
Well, that this is unconstitutional for
you. Okay, yeah. Now, and okay, yeah, good job. Yeah, big disadvantage you hear a lot of times on constitutionality. Okay, now, somebody, let's talk about this a little bit. The best way to work constitutionality probably is as a disadvantage. But let's discuss this a little bit. If you're going to say something is unconstitutional, is that going to win you the round? Say, oh, this bill is unconstitutional. Automatic win of the round. Yes or no?
Depends on your judge.
What do you have to do to make it? Is it a voting issue? Is it an issue the judge should vote on?
Yes.
Yes. Why yes?
Because if it's unconstitutional, I mean, everything in the Constitution is put there or amended for a pretty significant reason, and if it's violating one of those, then it's going to have pretty significant consequences.
Okay, well, let's talk about that a little bit. Let's see. The Constitution at one time allowed slavery in the United States and said that slavery counted as 3/5 of one person. So if our plan is to, do something, so if our plan 1859, our plan is to abolish slavery across the U.S. and, you know, that could, you know, we should allow somebody to vote who's under 21. Is that, because it's unconstitutional, is that a reason we shouldn't implement that? Anybody want to have thoughts on that?
No.
Because the problem is the Constitution is probably at some point, because it's been amended, it has some issues. It has some flaws. So just because something's unconstitutional doesn't mean, boom, we should vote on it because it's unconstitutional. Okay, I don't think that's far enough. So why is this an issue that we should be concerned about? Yeah. Yeah, Caitlin.
Do you use it as like an probably not be passed
somehow? No. Now, I'm not saying it's not a legitimate disadvantage. I'm just saying just because something's unconstitutional doesn't mean it's bad. So how do we flesh this out?
Undermines rule of law, democracy.
Okay, you could say something like that, yeah. And the point that I'm trying to get at here is, and with any argument, you just can't say it's unconstitutional. You need to impact why being unconstitutional is bad. You need to say something like it undermines the rule of law. That if we allow the Constitution to be broken in this one area, it opens up the door for threats in other areas. There's good cards about that that talk about that kind of thing. But just because something's unconstitutional does not provide a voting issue in the round. And again, you see some debaters in the South who are like, boom, unconstitutional, voting issue. Yeah, no, not necessarily. You need to impact that out a little bit further. And another point here too. Another kind of issue you have with constitutionality sometimes is some of these teams, when they take an interpretation of the Constitution back from like the 19th century, if you accept that interpretation of the Constitution, there's a ton of other things that are in violation of their interpretation of the Constitution that are going on today. So really, their constitutionality disadvantage is not necessarily unique. The Constitution is going to still be violated. So again, you know, there's some interesting ramifications there. Okay, anybody have, Shane, do you have something you want to say about that?
Yeah, I was wondering, just from a perspective, if you do have a legitimate possibility of your case being called into question for violating the Constitution, can you mandate a constitutional amendment to allow it?
Let's talk about that. What does the resolution say this year? Everybody. Okay, very good. Who's the actor in the resolution? Right. What does the United States federal government include? Supreme Court. Okay. What else? Okay. Now, what do you have to have in order to pass a constitutional amendment?
Ratification by the states.
Now, some definitions of the federal government, maybe you could put the states in there, but those are probably really wacky definitions. Generally, the states are not part of the federal government. So I don't think you can pass a constitutional amendment because you don't have the states on board. So that's a problem there. No fiat power. Right. So yeah, that would be one thing I would think about that. Again, though, can be a good disadvantage, though, especially if you can impact it all a bit further. So let's talk about a good place you can retrieve some cases. We've run this multiple times with as a disadvantage with various resolutions with different types of kind of points here. One kind of place that I find really useful, if you look at Cornell University, has a pretty good database of Supreme Court cases here. Let's try to pull this up.
Chris Baker, the other thing I was thinking about when they said that everything is, you know, unconstitutional, so many times you hear that in a playground, they say it's unconstitutional, and it's just a claim that's unwarranted
right.
And not impacted to the ground. When the campaign finance reform went through, everyone was saying that's unconstitutional. But until it's, you know, heard and everything, it's passed, and so it becomes law until the Supreme Court says it's unconstitutional. It's not. Even though they can say, hey, well, this part of the Constitution says this, and this says that. Well, that's a good argument, to bring before the
court. Right. I mean, technically, we're going to, I guess, go even a little bit further on that rabbit trail because I like that idea. I mean, technically, when you have an argument like that, I mean, if you're arguing something's unconstitutional, you really should probably have a Supreme Court case that you can maybe sort of reference to say that. You just can't say, our interpretation of the Constitution is this is unconstitutional. And by the way here, too, this is something you hear a lot of times, too. I have a quote from James Madison. I'm going to make a quote up from James Madison. I have James Madison. Who was James Madison in relation to the Constitution? James Madison did what? It's called what? Father of the Constitution, yeah. So I have a quote from James Madison that says, quote, reducing cafe standards is unconstitutional. Okay? That's my quote from James Madison. Cafe standards is unconstitutional. Now, is it like over for you as the affirmative team? And I say, we have the founding fathers. The founding fathers, according to my quote from James Madison, clearly believed that cafe standards were unconstitutional. So definitely, we need to vote against the affirmative team's plan. Now, that would be one of my flaws in my potential reasoning there.
They didn't have cars.
Okay, you're not allowed to question the legitimacy of my quote. My quote is ironclad. James Madison was a visionary. He saw into the future. He knew what America would look like 200 years from then. Okay, yes?
A couple hundred years old.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay, I'm thinking of something a little bit more, something else. Somebody else. Yeah, Caitlin.
It's a logical fallacy of part.
Okay, explain that to me.
Basically, just because one person said it doesn't mean that they all believe it.
Yes. There were over 50 people who signed the Constitution. Just because I have one person from the Constitutional Convention saying that they believe the Constitution means a certain thing doesn't mean that's what the plurality of representatives believed or the people that signed it. So that's a good point to make, too. Some people think just having somebody like James Madison or Thomas Jefferson, who wasn't even at the Constitutional Convention, come in and read a quote from them proves that you can show the AFF case is unconstitutional. Well, no. They need to have a Supreme Court case, and also you should question the fact that just because they have one person who says that doesn't mean that that's what the majority of the founding fathers even believed at the time. Yes?
And the reason I brought that up is so many in the homeschool community tend to think in black and white terms. And so always, if I'm constitutional, I respect the Constitution, so I'm losing that argument, so I better go somewhere else. Everything is centered around this debate.
That's right.
So
don't
be afraid to fight.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and let's see. Caitlin, I'll give you some credit for that. Good job. Sorry about that. Okay, let's do my search here. Let's see here. Okay, we got kind of diverted here. I think let me go back here. Let's go to, I think it's called Find Law at Cornell. I think my link there might have been faulty. I'm going to go to Google and look this up. I guess we went to Court Opinions right there. It would bring it to us. Yeah, I'm going to go back there. So you're probably going to need to break this down a little bit more if you go to U.S. Supreme Court opinions like that.
Does that find a lawyer like a hit list thing?
I don't think that this may pull you somewhat into this, but this is a little bit different. Okay.
Matthew, how have you used Supreme Court opinions in the past, in your experience?
We have had we'll use them on federalism disadvantages, like U.S. v. Lopez, things like that. We've also had... something before on ex post facto laws. We used the Constitution, then we pulled in a Supreme Court. Anybody here know what an ex post facto law is? Somebody? Yeah.
What?
An ex post facto law. Okay, get it before he Wikipedia's it in. What's an ex post facto law? Yes. Okay. Let our Wikipedia guy pull it up here.
How do you spell expos?
Oh. I'm not going to go that far. Yes, over here.
It's a retroactive law that affects things before the law was passed.
Right, yeah. Maybe it imposes penalties on actions that were done before the law was passed. Yeah, some teams actually do that on their cases, and that's a good thing to be thinking about. That's why a knowledge of the Constitution can be important in a debate round, because if you know that actually ex post facto laws are I don't guess banned by the Constitution is the exact right terminology, but the Constitution says that Congress is not allowed to pass an ex post facto law. If you know that kind of little twist there, that can be a good argument, because I've actually made it a couple cases that they're implementing an ex post facto law. So yeah, they're implementing penalties and other things on actions that occurred before their bill passed. Now let me just ask this. This would be interesting. Here we have a good group of homeschoolers. How many people have read the Constitution from cover to cover? Okay, let's see. How many people? Okay, most people have. Okay, so that's good. That was just a regular look here. Okay. Let's talk about looking up. Okay, and actually, if you look at it, looks like this is the way you can get to this this thing here. So let's type in our case here. Did I spell that right? Yeah, okay, we're getting it right here. I think this is right. Yes, I want to go to the syllabus. Okay, the syllabus here is kind of interesting because it shows us multiple things. We can actually look at the... Now, somebody explain to me. This is another kind of interesting thing you might want to know about a Supreme Court case. That actually we've had evidence that was used around that was really backfired on a team because it used a certain part of, I guess, what you would call the decision. Explain to me what these are. We have, it says that Kennedy here wrote the opinion, O'Connor wrote a concurrence, Scalia wrote a dissent, and Thomas wrote a dissent. Somebody tell me what those mean. Somebody that hasn't answered questions in a while, maybe, before I pick on somebody. Somebody in the back row want to maybe help me elucidate this. Okay, tell me, right here in the middle, tell me your name again. I'm sorry, I should know your name.
Sarah.
Explain to me what do you think some of these differences might be here. What's the difference between an opinion, a concurrence, a dissent? What does that mean?
Well, I know what an opinion is.
Tell me what an opinion is then. Tell me, what's an opinion?
An opinion is just someone's personal thoughts
on the issue. So this is just what Kennedy thought about this opinion. So just what Kennedy thought about the court case. It's his personal thoughts on the court case. Okay. Anybody want to disagree with that? Okay, Shane.
Okay, the opinion is the official decision of the court. And
right.
The reasoning and legal precedent that they set.
Right, so it's more than just what Kennedy thinks. It's what hopefully a plurality of the judges, at least initially, said they believed. Okay, what else?
The concurrence is whatever the judge was. I don't remember the name. That's also agreeing with the court's decision, but for different reasons.
Okay, yeah.
And then the dissents are the minority of the court writing their opinions on why the court was wrong or why they cast their vote in the opposite way.
Now, we've had a team before that, I guess on our D.C. gun ban case, they came in and they read a dissent as part of their evidence. That didn't work too well. They found out really quick that was not a good strategy for how to get information on that. So, yeah, you don't... The dissents generally are not a good place. I mean, there are some dissents that are famous, but they may be good for research. But yeah, generally would not want to card those up. Anyway, okay. So you can kind of see you can access those in various ways. And, one of the things also to be leery of here is these are very easy things to take out of context. You can get one little line that sounds like it says one thing, and debaters say, oh yeah, we got a good line here. You probably want to maybe even try to read a quick encyclopedia article or something about the case just to kind of get a general idea about what's going on before you actually try to use it because they can be somewhat complicated and you can really take stuff out of context. I've seen that occur some too.
Along those lines, do you know of anywhere that gives like a summary of Supreme Court decisions, like the basic philosophy?
I'm trying to think. Like I actually have like some encyclopedia that I look at. I've seen like it's like an encyclopedia, it's called like maybe the Oxford Companion to the Supreme Court that kind of lists a ton of cases. And actually this Black's Law Dictionary, and I think it at least used to do this, does it, like major cases, does it give a little summary? If you look, can you look it up by cases?
It's been so long since I've looked at
Black's okay. Dictionary. Black's Law Dictionary may do that as well, at least an older version. So, okay, let's look at some stuff. Okay. And a lot of, one place to sometimes get some good information from is like, I know especially on the eminent domain topic, like you were having tons of organizations that were filing like amicus briefs. Like you could grab an amicus brief that would be on the Cato website and that would be Cato's opinion of what eminent domain meant and they would be quoting stuff and it would be just a great kind of resource to get additional information from. Yeah, okay. Anybody here want to think they know what an amicus brief is? I mean, okay. Basically, and at least my understanding it is when you have a lawsuit or a case like this, you have two sides that each file their own brief. So we have the plaintiff would file a brief, the defense would file a brief, but then there might be a third-party organization that would like to submit a brief to the court that's not involved in the litigation, but they have an opinion that they would like the court to consider that could, you know, just independently file their own brief. They may have an attorney putting that together or whatever. So, yeah. Okay, and that actually brings me on a real rabbit trail here. Okay, while we're here, people get my impromptu handout real quick on think tank classifications. Okay, and everybody saw there was a link on the bottom that you could go. I think Wikipedia has a massive list of like a couple thousand, maybe international think tanks. They're not necessarily ranked by classification.
Did everybody get them?
Let me see. These are actually maybe. These are handouts for another day, I think. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, okay, that was. We're going to do a sources lecture tomorrow that talks a lot more about this, but I wanted to put something together for you guys just while you're researching real quick to hopefully help you out here. Okay, let's talk a little bit about U.S. Code, and we got to get moving here. U.S. Code, briefly, Codification of the Laws of the United States, 50 titles, has some famous titles here. I'm not trying to really get you on this. Now, some people have asked me a little bit. This is going to be a good potential bonus question. How could you potentially use U.S. code? What type of argument might you be using U.S. code to try to construct? And I'm not thinking disadvantage, so I'll use that as a hint. Somebody want to say something? Yeah.
There are going to be loopholes, maybe.
Nah, maybe. Somebody else have an idea here? Inherency. Yes. Inherency. That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Inherency. That'll tell you what the current regulations are, whatever. Yeah. So that can be good inherency evidence. Various breakdowns on that. When you cite that, it'll be easy to see. You want to cite all these subdivisions that's coming from. You can access that, and we'll get a website right here. Search U.S. code right through here. The House actually has a site on that, and you can also access the code by section. Again, Cornell University has a section on that, and U.S. House of Reps has a site on that too. But I want to move on. Now, let me just say this. When I think first places to research, I don't think U.S. code or code of federal regulations is the best initial place to research. That's generally when you're looking for something really specific. Maybe you've had a plan idea that's been around for a while. You've written your 1AC. It's generally not going to be the best place to learn about environmental policy. I'll give you guys a little bit of time to copy that down. And that kind of goes back, to what Mr. Sparks was even saying today. Is, primary sources are the place that you really want to make sure that there's accurate representation of the source, that kind of thing. But a lot of times, secondary sources can state it in a lot more accessible way to an audience and to a judge. And actually, some of this may not necessarily be something you could actually, we've seen some graphs and stuff today, and some stuff that teams have shown me. Can't really, that's very difficult to, cite in a debate round. So a secondary source that summarizes that can be very powerful, as long as they're doing it accurately. Yes.
Can I say, having done this, that Cornell is actually a lot easier if you're just trying to find something?
Yeah.
And if you want to double check it in the U.S. code, go to the government website and do a double check. But if you're doing any kind of searching, it's going to be a lot faster if you use Cornell.
And again, if you have access to LexisNexis, you could probably be pulling up some of these government resources. There are probably better ways to get to. But these are kind of freebies out there. Yeah, and one of the things that I'm saying, and I don't know why this is true, but literally, on any government website, it is it seems like they just do not construct their searches very well. If you search it through Google or search it some other way, because it's just very difficult to find information on searches directly on their site. Okay, we're going to need to skip through this real quick here. Code of Federal Regulations. Anybody brave enough to venture a guess at what the Code of Federal Regulations is about? Yes.
It's a code of all the federal regulations.
Okay, anybody else? We're just going to ignore that here. You know what? Actually, somebody has suggested that I do this, so I'm just going to officially do this here. I'm going to... we're going to give you the wrapper on that one. Here's the wrapper. Good job. Good job. Okay.
I know what it is.
Do you want another wrapper? Okay. Okay, tell us what it is.
It is the codification of the general and permanent rules and regulations.
Do you want to explain to me what that means?
Air pollution regulations, like what you can and cannot pollute,
who would this? Who would have quote unquote written this? Does Congress write this?
No.
Who writes it?
Regulatory.
Yes. Like now, is this considered a source of law? Because Congress didn't write it, Supreme Court didn't write it. Is it considered a source of law?
Yes.
Yeah. It's considered a source of law. Because, and this goes back to some of the points that we talked about, how sometimes Congress will pass a fairly open-ended mandate empowering or enabling the EPA to do something, or one of these other administrations, and they actually have to write down the specifics and codify all the specifics on that. Now, like I said, some points here. Now, I'm going to skip through this real quick. Now, let's talk about how you use this. One of the things I found very effective, this would be a great place to look for definitions of environmental policy. If you could find a definition of environmental policy here, or of any term, that would be, in my opinion, one of the best uses of something like this. You could say, hey, we actually have an agency that sat down and articulated what environmental policy is. There was a great definition during the Protectorate debate resolution where somebody had found a definition, an actual list. I think the EPA of all agencies had established a list of what U.S. federal protectorates were. That, like, was like basically the holy grail of definitions that year. Okay, again, a couple ways that you can search that, by title or searchable. We're kind of pushing time, so check that out. Okay, maybe there's some way we can try to get some of these slides distributed, because I don't want you to necessarily go through and hit all the URLs. The best thing to do is to say, hey, know this exists, be able to go check it out. Okay, congressional record. Again, this GPO is Government Printing Office. They have a lot of government publications there. There's a way to access that. We were talking about this a little bit earlier. One of the issues with this is if you're trying to search, and tell me what the congressional record is.
It'd be like the clerks taking notes on congressional sessions, right?
It could be like statements that were made on the House floor or something like that. Yeah. So, and they could maybe be writing it down. So it could be a good source of evidence. Again, the way that I would get this information, if I'm thinking, oh, I want to figure out what X congressman or X senator said about this bill, I would probably actually do a search on the House website and see if they've published a published statement. Now, not everything they do is a published statement, but believe me, if a congressman is making enough effort to have to go on the House of the floor and actually make a pre-prepared statement, which is kind of a lot of the ways that you see legislation in the United States, they are probably going to publish that and get as much mileage out of that as they possibly can, very likely. So very likely could be on their site. And again, the site may delete older stuff, but we kind of, again, have some of the issues that come in with dates here. Now, another thing, this is actually, we were talking the other day about how Google, with some of these, like and, you don't have to use and in a Google search because it automatically does that. If you want to use this, you're going to have to use and. If you put Durban environment in, it's going to look for the exact phrase Durban environment, and it'll really mess your search up. So you need to use ands and ors, kind of on both of this here, because it takes one term and considers it like a single phrase. So it's, again, not to me the best searchable thing. Okay, Office of Management and Budget reviews and approves agency budget requests to be sent to Congress. Evaluates. This is really good here. On some solvency points, some good arguments you can make. Actually, the team that's running Abolish the EPA, you guys might want to look into this. Maybe you want to see if you can find the Office of Management and Budget's assessment of the EPA and how well they've achieved President Bush's or President Obama's policy objectives. You can kind of get some good information. There's a report that's published. Let's see what I got on the next page here. Yes, expect more. Whitehouse.gov, OMB, expect more. Has a ton of agency reports about how the evaluating the effectiveness of various agencies, and that's very effective as solvency or responding to attacks on solvency or maybe running like an agency counter plan. You can also review their funding requests and those kind of things there. But the point that I'm making here is this is a great source to think, how have people evaluated this agency's performance? When it comes to implementing the AFP plan, what are some potential problems with that? And you can get an entire report on that from the Office of Management and Budget. So just know what that is. Maybe copy down the expect more extension on the White House website and try to go and check that out. But that's a good resource. Okay, Government Accountability Office. Its purpose is to audit, evaluate, and investigate arms of the U.S. government. And it's actually supposed to support Congress in doing that. So what kind of stuff can you get from there? A lot of times, again, the Office of Government Accountability Office publishes information on it evaluates different programs, that kind of thing. You can get in, if you do a search on, I think it's sitegoa.gov. Yeah, sitegoa.gov. And search like EPA, search CAFE, something like that. They often maybe do a performance review of a program that can be useful as evidence as well. So kind of an additional place in your arsenal for research there. Congressional Research Service. The U.S. Congress is spending $100 million on getting, and that's actually, to put this in perspective, the Heritage Institute's budget is $50 million a year, and the Heritage Foundation is like humongous on the amount of experts they hire and the amount of work they put out. So this is twice as big as the Heritage Foundation publishing information on various policies. So again, if you go to this website here, you can look at specific reports on various policies. And again, that's a good place to check out information on your plan as well, or on to get neg research. And that's pretty credible.
Can you use the Google search out like site?
Yeah, or also maybe put in CRS in your Google search, and yeah, that could potentially pull that up. So yeah. Okay, let's talk real quickly about international law, and then let me ask this. Somebody tell me, how could I use this evidence? How could I, if I could find that the AF case violated international law, how could I use this? Yes.
Disadvantages.
How could it be a disadvantage?
Disadvantages of other countries taking action against the U.S. because of it.
Okay, so there could be an impact of international repercussions, international backlash. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
I think you could say that it's a disadvantage because international law needs to be respected by us if we expect others to respect international law.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, there could be some points like that. Yes.
Can we make the point that it's illegal?
Why is it illegal? It's against what?
It's against international law. If it's against international law, if I heard you correctly, then for us, assuming we were part of that, then that would be illegal. At which point we're facing sanctions.
So why is illegal action bad?
Ooh, ethical.
International law. Well, I'd argue it.
Because the invasion of Iraq was illegal under international law. You know, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. There's a debate on that. But, you know, hey, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, yeah, I just think because something's illegal, you got to go maybe a little bit further, maybe have a rule of law impact, something like that. But and that's another point I made on all your guys' cases. We were talking about this team had a harm. They said, you know, we're increasing litter. And I was like, you just can't say you're increasing litter. You need to tell me why litter is a bad thing. Because who says litter is a bad thing? You know, you take that to the next level. That's always a thing in question. Okay, big point here, Constitution Article 6, basically any treaty becomes, the Constitution says it should be supreme law of the land. So essentially, if you're breaking an international treaty, you're actually breaking the Constitution kind of in a back door. And that's interesting, because let's talk about something like Kyoto. A lot of countries have signed Kyoto. The U.S. hasn't signed. The U.S. has signed Kyoto, and that's a good point, too, on another rabbit trail on a rabbit trail. Somebody, when we talk about international treaties, what has to happen for an international treaty to be passed in the U.S.? Yes.
Senate has to ratify.
And what else?
And the president has to sign.
Right. So, if something's been signed, like Clinton signed the Kyoto Protocol, does that mean it's a treaty in the U.S.?
No,
because the Senate like shot it down. I think it was almost unanimous. It was like maybe a 99-1 or 99-0 vote or something like that. Yeah, no, it's not. Wasn't ratified. So those two things have to occur. But after that occurs, treaty becomes the supreme law of the land. So, and we actually have this in the Blue Book Advanced. We have a huge list of, there's a huge list of international treaties that various cases violate, and some impact scenarios set up on that as a pretty good generic disadvantage there. And so anyway, you can look at, if you go here, search for treaties in force. There's a massive index, it's probably like over 1,000 pages long, that lists a huge list of treaties that are currently in force in the United States. And there's also a couple databases you could check out, multilateral treaties. What's a multilateral treaty as opposed to a bilateral treaty? Yes?
Bilateral is just two multilaterals.
Yes, good job. Yes, I think this is maintained by the UN. Yeah, treatiesun.org, or you could go to, again, to the Thomas. The Library of Congress website is really a website I would encourage you to look around. And another way, if you put in the name of the treaty, put in full text, that's a good way to potentially pull it up. So I think that's pretty much. Okay, anybody have additional comments, questions about information that we talked about? And a lot of government data, a lot of what this lecture was about was giving you, equipping you with sources to go look for stuff at. Anybody have questions, comments about that? Okay, we're going to wrap up. I think we have snacks over here. We're probably going to take maybe like a 15 to 30 minute break for snacks and then head back to work on research. Good job.